Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Curious Advantage podcast. This series is about how individuals and organizations use the power of curiosity to drive success in their lives and businesses, especially in the context of our new digital reality. It brings to life the latest understanding from neuroscience, anthropology, history, business, and behaviorism about curiosity and makes these useful for everyone. My name is Simon Brown. I'm one of the co-authors of the book, The Curious Advantage, and the Chief Learning Officer at Novartis. And today I'm here with my co-authors, Paul Ashcroft.
Hello.
And Garrick Jones.
Hi there.
And we're delighted to be joined by Peter Cheese, CEO of the CIPD, the professional body for HR and people development. Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, Peter.
Thank you, Simon.
So Peter is CIPD's chief executive. He writes and speaks widely on the development of HR, the future of work, and the key issues of leadership, culture, and organization, people, and skills. Peter has a very long list of credentials, including that he's a fellow of the CIPD, a fellow of the Australian HR Institute and the Academy of Social Sciences. He's also a companion of the Institute of Leadership and Management, the Chartered Management Institute, and the British Academy of Management. He's also a visiting professor at the University of Lancaster, and he's on the advisory board for the University of Bath Management School. He holds honorary doctorates from Bath University, Kingston University, and Birmingham City University. And prior to joining the CIPD in July 2012, he was chairman of the Institute of Leadership and Management, a member of the Council of Cities and Guilds. And up until 2009, he had a long career at Accenture, which is where I had the pleasure of working under his leadership when he was global managing director, leading the firm's human capital and organization consulting practice. So, Peter, let's kick off with a question on the role of the CIPD over the last year. As an Economist article recently pointed out, in this particular global crisis, HR are the heroes of most companies. So can you tell us what role has the CIPD been playing to support HR teams and organizations throughout the pandemic?
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree incidentally with that article. I think that this has never been a time where HR has had to step up more than it has in this context. Because at the end of the day, the pandemic is a human crisis. And of course, how organizations have had to adapt in terms of ways of working, keeping their people safe and all those things are very, very much people issues within organizations. So it has put immense pressure onto the HR function. They've very much been in the spotlight. And so we, in turn, as the professional body for HR and people development, have stepped up as well to work really hard to provide the support to the profession, all the way from guidance and sharing of what's happening, because after all, there are an awful lot of things happened, certainly in the early phases of the pandemic, with lots of new legislations and things that organizations had to pay attention to. So we spent a lot of time literally daily updating our, what we called our coronavirus hub, with all sorts of content and learning and advice and guidance. And we've continued to do that throughout. We've also opened up many more channels of connection to the community. So we've run literally hundreds of webinars and many other events of connection to the profession. Because at the end of the day, when any function, any team, any profession, any individual is under pressure in the ways that the HR profession has been, then community connection is a very, very big part of that. And that's a role that I feel strongly that we needed to play. And I'm proud to say that I think we did it pretty well.
Building on that, how have you seen organizations actually responding to such an unprecedented event? Because I mean, this is not something anyone was really prepared for or had any point of reference to know how to deal with.
Indeed, and you're right, and we might come back to sort of explore some of those wider thoughts about dealing with existential crises, which we weren't prepared for. But the reality is I think on a positive side, what I've heard so consistently from organizations is just how quickly they did have to adapt. It was forced of circumstance. I mean, the old necessity is the mother of invention stuff, but there is no doubt that what we've done, I think, as organizations, individually and collectively, over the last 6 to 9 months has been extraordinary. our ability to rapidly adapt to these changing circumstances, to work remotely and other things, to deal with the difference of our workforces, those who were essential frontline workers and those who could work from home, dealing with some of the huge challenges around mental health and well-being, putting people, therefore, front and center in the business agenda, and innovating. And I think those have been perhaps the two big things I call out. One is how much I've heard organizations say, this is the time we've had to put people front and center of the agenda and really care for them and connect with them and engage them and communicate and worry about their well-being. And the second, as I said, is this innovation, this ability to get stuff done really quickly. And what we've all heard so many times is we've done things in weeks that would have taken us months, if not years, in another context. So crisis is also opportunity. And I think that's what it's done in many ways, is create an opportunity and a stimulus for rapid change and adaptation. And the real question, of course, now is what do we take forwards as we begin to emerge from this pandemic?
Peter, I think that leads into a question I'd love to ask about. In the book, we've talked about how curiosity helps in responding to uncertainty, such, of course, as the current pandemic, through questioning, experimenting, and exploring. Have you been seeing this in practice?
Yes, I mean, I think unquestionably. I mean, the first point about questioning. So everybody's had to say, gosh, what does this mean to us? Where are our people working? Will our technology sustain remote working? Who are our essential workers? What have we got to do to protect people who still have to come into the office? So it's begun very much with that rapid set of questions that we all had to confront, that we, as we just said, we probably hadn't thought about very much before. Experimenting, yes, in the sense that although some people have called, of course, the pandemic the biggest experiment in home working we've ever had. But interestingly, some of what we've had to do in the first flushes of the pandemic, we barely had time to experiment. We just had to get on and do it and then learn as we go. Now, that is a form of experimenting as well. But it's not like, well, let's try a bit of this and try a bit of that. We sort of had to go out and said, look, we just got to make this work and we got to and then it sort of learn as we go kind of approach. So I think though, as the pandemic has gone on, what we have started in many organizations to do is to begin to ask this question about, so what have we learned? What are we going to do differently as a result of this pandemic? And interestingly to me, I think in the first few months of the pandemic, we were still hearing a lot of rhetoric from businesses and business leaders about, well, when this is over, we can all go back to normality. We can all go back to our offices and everything else. And people are using an expression of snapback. In other words, like we'd stretched out an elastic band, which was very, very challenging. And as soon as the pressure on that elastic band releases, because we get past the pandemic, we can snap back to what we were doing. The longer the pandemic has gone on, the less that language is really dissipated now. And I think it's much more about, to use another phrase that's very popular, building back better. So that's what I think we're now into a phase of, is saying, okay, so we've learned a great deal. We've adapted fast. We've experimented because we had to and learned as we went on. Now, what are we going to do with all of that learning to literally build back better, to create agility and innovation at the heart of our businesses, to put people at the very front of our business agendas, to embed well-being as an absolutely critical business outcome, and to take forward all the ways in which we communicated and broke down hierarchical barriers and silos and other things which so many of us have observed. But understanding one other really, really important point that we've learned through the pandemic, do you remember the language at the beginning of it, is that we're all in this together? Well, what we've very quickly learned is, no, we are not all in this together. We're, many different groups, segments of our societies, parts of our workforces have had to deal with this in very, very different ways. And whether it's your essential workers who still had to be there and therefore at risk, because they were on the so-called front line, or whether it's even your home workers, some of whom are working in very different circumstances. And it's one thing for a leader to be in their own home office, but recognizing also that many of their employees working from home might be sat on the edge of their bed or with all the other disturbances and things which are so much part of people's lives. So that's the other big learning. And therefore, as I said, building back better also means that we understand these differences of our workforce and different needs that people have. And we build that into our structural thinking for the future.
In some ways, we've been spending the last 30 years sort of encoding business and the internet and putting that into the world. And my personal view is we wouldn't have survived this pandemic if we'd not had those structures in place. Interested in what you were saying about the snapback, which has now moved away. Do you think that we've experienced a tipping point where we actually have shifted into a new digital reality that's going to define what business in the 20 and society in 2021 is going to look like?
Yeah, I think we have, Garrick. I mean, what I've often reflected though, I mean, I've always been extremely curious about the future work, and what we've been talking about over the last 10, 15 years is a very big debate about the future of work, a lot driven by, as you said, by digital disruption and all those sorts of things. So technology, everybody's seeing will profoundly impact the jobs, you know, the sort of work, the nature of work and jobs we do, the workforce itself and the workplace. And all the, so many of the trends and things we've been talking about, I think, have been now amplified through the pandemic. So I think in many ways, what we're seeing is that this pandemic is acting as a real catalyst for change, which we've been debating for a long time and not always progressing, I believe, in the ways that we should have been. And there's still so many paradigms of work which we've lived with for so long. You know, things like, you know, the standard working week of 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, the very slow progress of genuine flexible working, the cultures of presenteeism, where we judge people by how much we see of them and how much they spend sat in the office or whatever. So as I said, I think in reality that so many of the drivers of the future of work were already there, you know, not just technology, but social change and political change, economic change and so on. But that the pandemic has acted as a profound catalyst for real change. And therefore, I believe that we will look back on this time as almost an era-defining moment that really did shape a different future of work, which built very strongly on the principles of this idea of, you know, people at the heart of business, the ideas of that if we believed in sort of standardized models and approaches to everything in the past, because that was an easy way to reduce uncertainty. Now, it's not about that. It's about understanding the dynamics of your own organization, the needs of your people and your workforce, being able to be adaptive and agile and flexible and responsive. It's all of those watchwords, which after all are not new. None of those words are just listed out there are new words, but it is absolutely apparent, I think, to so many people now, those are the things that we've learned more about in this pandemic that we have to take forwards.
Do you think this puts us in a stronger position? I'm thinking specifically around the UK. You know, the UK is facing so much ambiguity at the moment. Organizations, society, we have a double challenge, not only the pandemic, but we have Brexit going on. This is another huge unknown in terms of how it's going to play out. How are you seeing organizations respond and how are you advising leaders to prepare given all of this ambiguity?
Yeah, I think as you rightly say, Garrick, I mean, the Brexit thing is another big uncertainty. And let's not forget, it's not just the UK. I mean, interestingly, every time I've been to Ireland in the last 3 or 4 years, they've been talking more about Brexit than often we have in the United Kingdom. But Brexit is another example of wider sort of geopolitical shifts and change and some of this extraordinary debate that I've always found very curious about a world where we were moving what seemed to be inexorably to sort of big globalization and free flow of goods, services and labor across borders. And then a lot of rhetoric, not just Brexit, but a lot of rhetoric about, well, actually that's not good for everybody. And maybe we need to be looking after our own more and ideas like that. But to answer the question directly, I think the reality is that what we have to be able to do is to embrace uncertainty as part of the paradigm of every business context and understand uncertainty and understand the opportunity and understand also that there are, you know, I love that expression and I can't exactly source it. Some people say it came from Donald Rumsfeld, but there are known knowns, there are unknown knowns, there are known unknowns, and there are unknown unknowns. And I think a really important part of the mindset of curious thinking is to understand those different things and understand that even if I take Brexit, there are plenty of known knowns, there are plenty of known unknowns as well, and the probably unknown unknowns. But that's the whole mindset, I think, of curiosity, is to be able to live with uncertainty and embrace it, and then to use it as a trigger for innovation and agility and adaptability, as I've said. So what we are advising businesses to do is to say, you can't sit here and wait for things to be described to you. I mean, again, it struck me as curious in the early stages of the pandemic, when the government was trying to write loads of rules about everything, and then businesses coming back to them and say, well, what am I supposed to do in this circumstance? What's the rule for that thing? And you think, but you can't define the world in that way. You cannot define what is a VUCA world, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous, by pretending that somebody's got a big rule book that we can all just obey and then that will solve our problems. So yeah. I think it's, first of all, embracing the idea of uncertainty, therefore embracing the idea of innovation, agility, and adaptability. It is absolutely, therefore, being able to listen to all voices in your organization and understanding that leadership is not just about command and control, and because I'm the leader, I know everything, because I certainly don't. And I think it has created a greater sense of humility in leaders through this pandemic to understand what they do not know, and therefore they've also got to really engage and work with others right across their organization and take feedback and input and come up with to some degree, a collective view. And then the other big part of it is to put some structure in your long-term thinking as well. So a very good example of that, which we're encouraging businesses everywhere on, is strategic workforce planning, or building out a proper people strategy. Because it's something I've observed for a long time through my career at Accenture and beyond, that we have not in businesses done enough thinking about this critical part of what business is about, which is about people, about their skills and capabilities, about where we get the skills and capabilities that we need for the future, about our operating models and organizational cultures and all those sorts of things, which are so elemental to business strategy, but not always being well enough articulated or understood. So through this crisis, and certainly what I'm seeing now, because of the additional uncertainties of things like Brexit, which after all, in very direct terms for British-based businesses, is meaning things like the easy access to migrant labor, which we've had in the United Kingdom for a long time, is almost certainly changing. So you're back to the known knowns again. So say, right, deal with those known knowns. So we know that our supply of labor is going to change. We know that mm-hmm. There is a lot more agility we've got to build into our businesses in innovation. So let's start to think differently and strategically about the kind of skills and capabilities and culture that I'm going to need. And then to use, and Simon and I were both Accenture alums, so I'm borrowing an expression they've used, which is when you think about your future workforce, you've got to think about, do you buy, build, borrow, or bot? In other words, are you going to hire in the skills? Are you going to develop the skills? Are you going to borrow the skills in terms of contingent labor or partnering and outsourcing? Or are you going to automate? And those are big conversations which I'm seeing happening far more now because of what is going on with these various things, the pandemic and Brexit and so forth, than I've seen in a very long time, or probably ever. And frankly, as I said, were much, much needed, because these are critical parts of business strategy and thinking.
I mean, what we are seeing as well is this acceleration of skills, and I guess the pandemic has really brought that to the front of virtual working and other things that people suddenly needed. In our case, in Novartis, was over the course of a weekend. And if we look at the research, I think Gartner talks about a third of people having learned a new to world skill in the last 3 years. The World Economic Forum published something recently that 50% of people will need reskilling in the next 5 years. So from the interactions that you're having, Peter, with companies, are you seeing that people are seeing this need for new skills, and how are you advising people on actually tackling that rapidly changing skills agenda?
Yeah, I definitely am, Simon, but it goes back to a point I made earlier, which is that this is not new. I mean, to use another survey, the Open University recent, and we've done very similar research that shows the same things. I think they said 6 out of 10 organizations are facing critical skill shortages, which is, in their leaders' views, holding back their ability to do all the things they need to do. These are not new issues. But I think, to be honest, as I said, we haven't confronted these sorts of questions strategically. And to confront a question of skills shortfalls, you've got to think strategically. You've got to think about these options I've got. Is it contingent labor? Do I outsource it to somebody who's got the skills? Do I really get on top of my learning and development and make that far more agile? Or do I automate it and change the nature of the job in some way? And it's not saying nobody's done those things, but the reality is we haven't done enough of these things. And therefore, whilst it of course the pandemic has accelerated, and I think actually Brexit as well, as we just touched on, has accelerated an understanding in many businesses' minds about, oh my goodness, where am I going to get these skills from? This is not new. It's just that the pandemic, again, as I said, and some of these other existential things like Brexit, have absolutely accelerated the need for it. And therefore, I think the focus of attention on these issues, which is a good thing.
Yeah, and they also demonstrate how hard it is to predict some of these things as well. So I'm not sure a year ago anyone would have predicted where we are now, and some of the skills that are needed to support where we are now. So all the more, I guess, need for people to put the attention in to try to figure out what will be the skills that we need in the future.
Yeah, indeed. But, you know, as various people have talked about the pandemic, it was not, to use Nick Taleb's black swan thing, it was not a black swan. We knew that one of the biggest risks to humanity, if you will, was a global pandemic. And a lot of people have talked about it. I mean, to go back to the Rumsfeld thing, it was, in my view, it was a known unknown, right? So we knew it was unquestionably a risk, but it was unknown when and how it might happen. And it is very hard for businesses to prepare themselves for these sorts of things, or indeed societies and governments. But I think the other thing that it must teach us is to think more long-term. And one of the biggest challenges we've had, and unfortunately sad to say, I think the UK, as many people have commented, is probably worse on this than many places, is we do not think long-term enough. There's a real short-termism. And this is one of the, you know, to extend the thought further, one of the real debates about some of the shortcomings of modern capitalism that, you know, if we're beholden to the shareholder and the shareholder is demanding very short-term returns and we're rewarding leaders accordingly, we have built too much of a culture in too many businesses, which is very much about short-termism and short-term, you know, I'll do this because I know it'll give a kick in my share price or whatever. And yet some of the things we're talking about now, like investing in the skills and capabilities of our people in our organization, building resilient cultures, really looking strategically at these questions, and then investing in the right ways in a strategic context, even preparing for the sort of the known unknowns like a pandemic or whatever. That is what we still got to learn. And I think, you know, to come back to the Brexit question too, I think, and this is a very difficult one, because the general consensus view is that we have not prepared enough in business for Brexit. And then in a business's defense, then we would say, yeah, but what exactly are we preparing for? So you're back to then this analogy, which is, well, it's not that the whole of Brexit is unknown. It's not that, okay, we haven't figured out all the trade deals, but we can absolutely say yes, but our access to migrant talent is something we should be and should have been planning for quite some time, because we knew that was going to happen. A slightly different regulatory framework, we knew that was going to happen. We knew we would probably have to adapt our business models to support a different way of trading and dealing with Europe. And so those are really important things. But as I said, my big point on this, and many others have observed it, and I do believe it's a challenge for us as businesses and business leaders, is how do we think long-term and strategically? And the danger is when we are working in a world which is more and more uncertain, then the ability to think long-term can get even more challenged, because you can always fall back on, well, I don't know what's going to happen in the next week, let alone in 5 years' time. So how am I supposed to plan for that? I just got to be agile and adaptive and nimble, which are important. But it does not mean to say that you're not also thinking in a strategic context. So I've at least got to the parameters of my strategy into which I'm going to adapt as I move forward. And just to build on that thought, one of my favorite models that has described that thinking is mission command and mission objective, which is very much what was embraced by the military as and it wasn't a modern phenomenon. I mean, it's talked about way back, I think, by the Prussians or even Napoleon. But the idea that central leadership sets broad parameters, but you've got to have teams on the ground who can be agile and adaptive to the exact circumstances in which they find themselves. And then you think about modern business culture over the last 20, 30 years, and it hasn't really been doing that. It's been built on a paradigm, as we touched on briefly before, of trying to create certainty, of command and control, of writing lots of rules, of dealing with best practice and all those sorts of things, which in ways I think have been to try to make a complex, uncertain world simplified and understandable, because we are often too challenged as humans, I suppose, and certainly as leaders, to deal with this paradox of uncertainty. And yet, again, to come back to the pandemic, that must have taught us that we have to deal with uncertainty. We got to understand it and understand what we can deal with and what we can shape and where the opportunity is and how we learn differently and how we, as I said, embrace uncertainty as part of our strategic thinking and not think that everything can be reduced to rules and policies and best practice.
You're listening to the Curious Advantage podcast, inspired by the book The Curious Advantage, written by Paul Ashcroft, Simon Brown, and Garrick Jones. Subscribe to the podcast today.
Peter, do you have some examples of companies, organizations, or types and shapes of organizations that you've seen this year that have responded well? For example, Novartis have placed curiosity and the investment in their people as one way to work through and say survive and thrive through the pandemic. Do you have other examples of organizations that have responded well to this?
I mean, it has been extraordinary to me just how businesses have responded. I mean, let's take retailers. I mean, gosh, what have they had to do? Now, interestingly, of course, if you look at retailers now and say, well, which are the ones that have really come through this? You know, it is, and we're not fully through it, but are likely to come through and survive. And which are the ones that are really struggling? Now, at one level, you can look at it as sort of size, because if I'm a two-person sandwich bar in the city of London, really, really difficult to adapt. And yeah, which is not to say that some of them haven't. I mean, you've seen some of these smaller restaurant businesses and retailers just figuring out a different way to distribute their product. If the customer can't come to them, how do they go to the customer? But to be honest and to be frank, I mean, when you look at some of the failures like, you know, Arcadia Group and Debenhams and so forth, what rings out is they have not been agile. They've not been adapting. They have not seen that the world, even before the pandemic, was changing, that buying patterns were changing, they needed to invest more in technology so that they could be prepared for a different future. Hence, as I said, I think there are lots of good examples of, let's take retailers or banks, financial services companies, utilities, many others that have really responded well because they actually have been understanding that a lot of these trends, which have been amplified by the pandemic, were happening around them, and they needed to be able to do that. And then they've accelerated their innovation through the pandemic. I think it's also fair to say, when you look across sectors, of course, some sectors have boomed. You know, let's take online retailers as a great example, or tech companies, or companies that do video calls and all those others, absolutely massively boomed. Public sector itself, yes, had to adapt. Of course, it's had to adapt. But by and large, it's continued because we needed all these public services. And we've all understood, again, what was essential services to keep our lives going. But as I said, I look at sectors like retail, which has been immensely challenged. I look at sectors like hospitality, immensely challenged. And some of those who've really adapted have done some extraordinary things. But as I said, it's because I think the survivors and the adapters already had some of that thinking in their DNA. And the ones that didn't are the ones that are struggling. Also, I think another thing, we just released some interesting research with Bath University and Veronica Hope Haley about trust. So one of the things that how CEOs have responded through the crisis, and one of the things that we really recognize is that if your organization was in a place where there was good trust within the organization and beyond it, also that you were already, you know, working and understanding that the context in which you're operating was changing, so we have to invest in some of the things already, then you were far, far more likely to come through this. And as I said, therefore, there are many, many very positive examples of that that we've seen.
We've been talking to some amazing people on our podcast series. One which comes to mind is the conversation we had with Chris Meyer, who's the, you know, complex dynamic systems guy. Mm. And he was talking about how the need for curious organizations, a little bit like ants going after what he called the Big Mac, how we've come from the Big Bang to the Big Mac, and how the anthills send out all of these, you know, ants which go after the food. But unless they have other trails going after other food sources, if they lose the main source of their income or their food, and unless they have those other scenarios in place within the organization, they can't pivot. They've got nothing to pivot to. And part of that also, which reminded me what you were talking about, was the pyramid shift, how we've moved from a command and control situation very, very rapidly to this kind of cloud of connected individuals, many of whom have access to as much information as people used to have at the top. And so all of that has been turned on its head. I guess my question then is really about what role you see education and curiosity in particular, and the education of curiosity playing in building skills in organizations for the future, and also the workforce for the future.
Yeah, it's a great question, Garrick. And, you know, in preparing for this podcast, I was trying to sort of get my own head around the notion of curiosity. And, you know, Simon had obviously pointed me to the book, and you sent me a copy, and I was reminding myself of it. But the reality of curiosity, I think it's a critical mindset. I mean, and, you know, I've sort of asked myself the question also, is it a skill or is it? It sort of is in some ways, but I think it's as much a mindset as it is a direct skill. And what I mean by that is that when I think about myself, I genuinely do believe I'm curious. I'm always interested in, I never stop learning. And I think one of the greatest gifts in life is learning. And one of the sad parts about education is somehow for too many people, you'll hear them say, oh, thank goodness I finally graduated. That's the end of my education. I don't have to do exams anymore. When in fact, learning in education in its wider sense is a true life gift and something that we should all embrace. And therefore, good education teaches people to learn as much as it teaches them facts and figures and all these other things. And it is absolutely, as we've already explored, I think, an inherent, whether you call it mindset or skill, that we need at all levels of organizations, and particularly at leadership levels. So a couple of thoughts that sort of link to that. One is, I quite like models like spiral dynamics, I don't know if you're familiar with it, around leadership, and it's talked about in wider contexts as well. But this idea that the sort of evolutional or developmental thinking, where you move up this sort of spiral from one where you start by everything's got to be, you know, rule-bound and constrained, otherwise I can't understand it. I've got to have certainty. I've got to have process and structure and all these other things. All the way up to a world where actually you embrace uncertainty and paradox and all those other things. You're seeking to learn all the time from that. You're always questioning. And indeed, you know, I think it's almost true to say that as leaders, it's not so much that we need to know the answers to the questions. We need to know the questions to ask. And it's building that sort of mindset. So, and that is again, as we've already explored, is so fundamental in a world which is so uncertain. It demands that we are curious as leaders and as business people. It demands that we seek to figure out what the questions are rather than thinking we've got to know all the answers all the time. And that we look at, in a systemic way, in a sort of systems thinking way, across lots of different disciplines, which is why I love the tee up that Simon gave to this podcast. The reality is, and this is how I think about my own curiosity, is I try to think about things in a very multidisciplinary way. I'm fascinated by history, by science, by astrophysics, by culture and art and all these different things. And you realize that increasingly it's not just because I find those things interesting. It actually helps you in your own development, and it helps you with this idea that you never stop learning, and it's one of the greatest gifts. And I think it also then adds to the idea that if I sort of play on that thought, that as leaders or as anybody, that it's not so much can I answer the question, is it do I know the questions to ask, also teaches a sense of humility, because this has been another problem with, you know, charismatic leadership, command and control, and all this stuff, is that we expect, and indeed the leaders felt this is how they had to act, that they're the ones that need to know everything and tell everybody what to do. And how can you in a highly uncertain world? So, you know, and then to sort of draw it back into the roots of education too. I'm sure you're familiar with Ken Robinson's TED Talk, you know, back in the 90s, and sadly he passed away a month or two ago. I mean, one of the most watched TED Talks, and I rewatched it again recently. And he talks about creativity, which is, again, I know very much in your thinking about the idea of curiosity. And he said, and he really did believe it, and he's an educationist, really believed that actually, unfortunately, our traditional models of education squeeze out creativity because it becomes so sort of directed towards very specific learning outcomes and passing exams and specializing, and unfortunately in the UK, or I should probably say more accurately, the English educational system in particular, we confine and specialize people so early on. And then interestingly, you get into the world of work, and sometimes we exacerbate that even further, don't we? I mean, we say, right, to really get on, you've got to have a deep skill and knowledge. And it's not true in every organization, but in organizations I've worked with where specific and deep skills are more revered, then you find an even more arguably narrowness of thinking. So academics, interestingly, you'd think, are academics curious? Well, yeah, to some extent they are, but to some extent they're not, because they tend to think, I've got to make my name in a particular field, so I'm going to study it in massive detail, and actually using confirmation bias almost to say, well, I'm sure I'm right with my hypothesis, so I will push away ideas that conflict with that. And that is a really elemental idea of curiosity, is you don't push away ideas that conflict with your worldview. Researchers and technologists, there are lots of examples. I mean, Simon, you must see it to some extent in a company like Novartis, which is, after all, built very strongly from their idea of deep specialist knowledge. And so there's a real challenge of education, of getting the balance right, and indeed in workforce development and people development, of the balance between the need for specialist skills, but not then using that to constrain the idea of curiosity and ongoing learning.
A curious culture is a game changer. What does curiosity mean for you? Follow hashtag Curious Advantage and join the conversation.
And we talk in the book about criticality and confronting one's own biases. So it isn't just, you're seeing an answer and it's a confirmation bias of what you were expecting, but actually being aware of the things that are influencing you and embracing those differences, or embraces things that didn't turn out as expected, to actually, I'd be curious to understand them and what we can learn from them. I was really interested by what you're saying about questioning as well, because we had Lisa Bedell on the podcast a few weeks ago, and she wrote the book Kill the Company, which talks all about killer questions. And she talked about how actually crafting questions is so much more important than actually the answers, because through Google and things you can find the answers to so many things now, but actually it's asking the right questions that is the skill that we should be developing for the future. And from what you were saying, often education is around the focus on the right answer, as opposed to being curious and really thinking about the questions we should be asking.
Yes, I think very much so, and absolutely believe in that view. It's about knowing the questions to ask. And as you said, just to amplify that thought about Google, I mean, we live in this extraordinary time, don't we, that the access to information and knowledge has never been so great. And I can't remember all the stats, but people talk about things like in the last 2 years, we've put more data and information out there than we've had in the whole of humanity or whatever. I mean, some really extraordinary sort of thoughts in that regard. But what it then creates is absolutely that challenge, which is, so I've really got to know the questions to ask. because it also links to this idea of what is truth. And I think that's another big challenge for all of us, isn't it? Which is, you know, we've heard these expressions, we live in a post-truth world, or there are alternative facts, which I've always found a bit of an oxymoron. But nonetheless, and I suppose that's the point of it, it is an oxymoron. But the reality is, therefore, it reinforces that idea, is that we've got to know the questions to ask. We've got to know what to challenge. And if we see some piece of data or a point of view or a perspective, you know, what's the evidence that underpins it? And therefore, that speaks strongly to the idea of curiosity. You don't just go to one place to get some piece of data. You may have to go to many places to get corroborating evidence, different perspectives, different points of view, and then add it up so that you can reach a balanced conclusion and decision and judgment as to what to do. And that is arguably not what we've particularly taught people to do, or indeed in business. Now, I mean, I'm not just talking about education, but in business as well. And yet we are, in these times of great uncertainty, flooded with data and knowledge and points of view and alternative facts and all of that. So it really amplifies that idea of curiosity and the ability to know what questions to ask, not to, can I answer the question.
The development of the vaccine this year and the speed at which that has been done, Peter speaks to that, right, does it not, in terms of the way organisations and obviously the large pharmas have shared knowledge, shared information and collaborated and worked together to achieve that?
Yeah, I mean, that's another important point, Paul, absolutely. I mean, I think it's moving beyond this idea of knowledge as power as well, which is a really difficult one, because the more specialist I am and the more that is what defines me, which is why, as I said, I think I've noticed with academics and researchers and specialist engineers to a degree, is that if that's what defines me, then at one level I have to sort of protect it, because if I let it all go, then that won't define me anymore. But of course, there's another very important part of this idea of knowledge as power, which is this sense of this sort of protective shield, that if I know something you don't, then that's my power over you. And after all, that has been used an awful lot in business as well. So you're right. I think that what we have experienced through the pandemic of this collaboration on vaccines and sharing of undoubtedly what would have been protected as corporate IP in many, many different guises in the past, perhaps that is a real object lesson in the absolute benefit of opening up our silos of knowledge and connecting, which is a tough debate. I mean, you know, again, you look at particularly pharma, I mean, gosh, after all, I mean, protecting the secret source and how you came to particular drugs and all those before they get released as generics. I mean, it's tough, but even if you separate it from the idea of organizations sharing knowledge in this way, let's talk about it within organizations, because as I said, this construct of knowledge is power. I've seen so much, and how much people therefore don't collaborate enough within organizations and therefore get the best of innovation, because that's where it comes from. All these different ideas coming together and all these different perspectives. And if you've got lots of people working in a way that says, well, I've got to protect that knowledge because that's my power, then you're working against all these ideas of innovation and agility within organizations. And again, as we've explored, this pandemic, I think, has hopefully put a bit of a charge under those sorts of ideas to say, we have to think differently. Agility comes from the idea of bringing many different perspectives and inputs and sharing it so that we can come to the right answer together. And then, as you rightly said, Paul, you extend that even up into these massive, wicked problems that we've had to deal with of how you find a vaccine.
And Peter, we're coming to the end of our conversation, regrettably, but it's fascinating. I've got two questions for you, I think. What are you personally curious about at the moment? And you talk broadly about your multidisciplinary approach to just enriching the context that you're living in. And what are you personally curious about at the moment? And what would be the one thing that you would want our listeners to take away from today?
Yeah, I mean, really important points, Garrick. I mean, I suppose what I think about at the moment is, which is going to sound very sort of broad, but what next? I mean, as I said, I do think we're in an era-defining moment, and I love this quote, and I think it was Drucker who said, you know, the best way to predict the future is to help to shape it. I think it's never been more true than now. So I'm very, very curious about sort of where next. As we've explored, I think there'll be many trends which are driving a very different future of work from the kind of work environment and world that so many of us, well, we've all grown up in. And I think there's such opportunity to create everything from more balance of life. I mean, when you think about the world of work, that's created a world where we don't have proper inclusion and equality of opportunity. We do not have, we got far too much mental health issues, and we know from our own CIPD research that stress is the biggest source of absenteeism from work. We got inequality of wealth and income distribution, which is calling out much bigger ideas about, well, if capital can displace them, it's going back to old ideas, even back to Karl Marx, which is why he's being sort of dusted off a little bit. Not that we want to reintroduce communism, but some of these ideas of sort of wealth distribution and modern capitalism. So I think we're just in this extraordinary time when what really fascinates me is what next? Are we really going to move, as I said, into a very different paradigm of how we work and how we see organizations and the real responsibility of businesses to be part of society, not apart from society, which I think in many cases they've thought of them themselves, they're not part of society. Business is part of society and it's fundamental to the healthy functioning societies as well as economies. So we've got all this opportunity ahead of us, and that's what I'm curious about. And therefore, what I think about is, so what can we do to shape that future? What can any of us do? What I can do? What we can all do to shape a more positive future for the world of work, and therefore, you know, addressing some of these bigger challenges that we've had for a long, long time. So that would be how I'd express it. And therefore, that makes me continue to be really, really curious about everything from the development of artificial intelligence to social and demographic shifts and these ideas of younger generations saying, well, it isn't all about the money, is it? It's about purpose and it's about social responsibility and all these sorts of things that are going on. And I suppose my takeaways for listeners would be, you know, I express this idea that I think one of the greatest gifts that we have is learning and knowledge. And what has saddened me throughout my life and what I've tried to coach and counsel others on is where I see people miss their own personal opportunities, or they don't find their own personal talents and interests, or maybe they only find them very late in life when they finally break the bounds of what they might have seen as a constrained world of business where they were abiding by various rules, and suddenly they break free from that and they go into retirement and discover something new. So the greatest gift is learning and knowledge, and we need to continue to learn and develop knowledge. And that, I think, is the essence of curiosity, and keep asking those questions, which helps us develop as individuals, certainly helps us develop as leaders, and I think helps us to be more effective. And the other point, which is linked to it, I think is, as I said, if you think about it from this paradigm, which is, I need to know what questions to ask, not endlessly thinking, I either know all the answers or need to know all the answers because that's what people look to me for. And that is, I think, quite a paradigm shift. And it speaks, therefore, also to this idea of humility. Because the more we know and the more we learn, certainly in my experience, the more we understand what we don't know. And that, I think, is a really, really important sort of mindset about curiosity, which is that curiosity speaks to that idea that the more we know, the more we realize we don't know. And I'll use another little piece from another discipline, which is science and cosmology and things like that. You know, I think it was Yuval Harari in his book Sapiens, and others have commented on it, that when we got to the end of about the 19th century, a lot of science was, everybody believed, we kind of figured it all out. We'd sort of roughly knew what the atom was and things like that. And then in the subsequent years, when they got within the atom, they realized, oh my goodness, we don't even know the half of it. And the more we've gone on, actually, the more, even in science, that we realize the things that we don't know. And that, to me, is the essence of curiosity. But it is also the essence of what I think is what makes us human and what makes life so engaging and so interesting and so exciting, is to keep on learning.
What a fantastic point to wrap up on, the essence of curiosity, of the more we learn, the more we realise that we don't know. So massive thank you for joining us, Peter. It's been great having you on the podcast.
My real pleasure. And as I said to you all at the very beginning, I was looking forward to this conversation. I think it's a really good book, and it's such a good notion. And I think it's a very powerful one, particularly in these times.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast. The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon. Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and John McGinty and edited by Jill Damatak-Futter.